So, for this evening's entertainment, I have the delightful topic of sila, or morality, which most people who undertake any mode of religious training will be engaged in to at least a small degree. So, you know, why does if you look at, say, like a humane or worldly perspective, why is it necessary for human beings to even have, you know, to even say keep a foundation of morality or observe precepts whatsoever? I mean, you know, like why should you? You know, why can't you just, in general society, just basically just do what you like when you like? But as it's quite clear to the vast majority of you that essentially that human beings have to keep their behaviour within an acceptable parameter, because if we don't, our behaviour becomes an affront or offensive to other people that we associate with in the general community. And, you know, naturally we have government regulations, we have, you know, community law, and then we have, within the domain of personal behaviour, which is where sila or morality lies. And naturally the Buddhist system is very, very clear and articulate on the moral structure that we keep, you know, and you know, being based on the five precepts, you know, the five Buddhist precepts for the lay fraternity, you know, the 10 rules for the novice monks, and the 227 for the full monks, and the 311 for the bhikkhunis, the fully ordained nuns. So, you know, you have this underlying moral structure that people are essentially, you know, if you're a religious practitioner, you're under, say, like a minimum obligation to follow, because, you know, if you consider yourself to be a religious person or a spiritual person, but you're completely unrestrained, completely hedonistic, and, you know, you just essentially just do whatever you like at any time, that, your behaviour is going to be a source of maybe great concern or irritation to the people who associate with you. So, you know, the bottom line is that when we keep a moral baseline, you know, what's the actual result? You know, if we keep morality, a foundation in morality, what is the significance? You know, what is the worth of that? And, you know, a lot of this is based on, like, common sense principles and observation. And so, you know, you just speak, you know, within your own mind, you know, you can picture the people that you know who are good people, decent people, you know, reasonably trustworthy and reliable, because, you know, naturally not every single human being is bulletproof. Even close family members, even mum and dad, have their, you know, both their strengths and weaknesses on a moral level. But, you know, when we visualize or bring those people to mind, you know, essentially the person who, you know, whose behavior is, say, based in goodness, you know, wholesomeness, the kind of behavior that we see is a sense of, you know, say, like, a minimum level of, say, friendliness, kindness, potentially compassion, you know, trustworthiness, you know, a person who has a baseline of essential human qualities on the heart level. And, you know, they're the kind of people that, that we like to associate with, you know, the kind of people that we feel, you know, feel good when we're, you know, when we relate to them, when we connect with them. You know, they're not the kind of people who make you unsure or fearful or give you rise to doubt or worry or to or concern. You know, it's the kind of personality which encourages a sense of, say, confidence and trust, you know, at least to a, you know, small degree. You know, people's personalities, their characters are, you know, can be, you know, people fluctuate. You know, everybody's character is in a state of change, and you know, not even your closest friends and associates, you know, they're not absolutely bulletproof. They're going to have their good days, their bad days. You know, they're going to, you know, they may be a source of inspiration, a source of disappointment for you. You know, depending what's actually happening at any day, say any day of the week. But essentially, the people that you feel, you know, are good human beings, you know, you feel that sense of confidence, openness, trust, and you know, you feel that you can spend your time with these people quite comfortably, which is a very, you know, a very, very beneficial principle for, say, like good human relationships. So, you know, when we look at the structure of the five Buddhist precepts, you know, number one, not to kill, yeah, say like any being. And when we say like any being, it can be, say, small or quite large, you know, like the size of the size of an elephant down to the size of an ant, or, you know, even a small mouse. But the criteria itself is, you know, that particular being, you know, must have consciousness. And, you know, so naturally, the body and mind go together, body and mind complex. And, you know, when we talk about consciousness, the consciousness of a being, it's the four, you know, the four mental aggregates which make up mind, consciousness, you know, which lie within the sphere of that, say, that physical organism, you know, being, you know, whether it's small or large, you know, the mental aggregates of feeling, you know, perception, you know, mental formation, which is like the activation of say the full thinking process. And then the consciousness, the conscious awareness of that process. So, you know, that's the mind component, which lies within that individual or that being. So, you know, we have this intention. You know, we don't intentionally, the guideline with the precept is not to intentionally deprive a being of life. So, you know, on the level of the mind, you know, when you look at the way your mind projects itself from its base, as soon as your mind moves within the process of, say, thought construction and it's like realistically, like emotional, say, activation, because your thought processes, you know, without feeling, without emotion, your thought processes are quite neutral. And they don't really have any real power within themselves until you emotion imbued, you know, contained within that thinking process, because, you know, your feelings give your life color and experience. You know, they give your life tangibility. So, you know, as your mind moves, you know, under the power of intention, your mind's moving in a particular direction, and it has a goal. So, you know, as your mind moves from its, say like a base of stillness, a state of, say, like restfulness, the mind moves out, and then thought construction, takes place, you know, imbued with feeling, and then one sees exactly what one's intention is, you know, whether you want to, you know, there's numerous possibilities you could move in. You know, I mean, the classic things that, you know, people may want to deprive a living being of life because, you know, I mean, they're hungry, they're starving, they need to survive, they need to live. And when we look at, say, like wild creatures in the animal kingdom, they're essentially ruled by their predatory instincts, and they're not going to be thinking too deeply about whether they want to sort of spare the life of that rabbit or maybe that antelope. You know, when they're hungry, you know, predatory animals, you know, wolves, you know, big cats and the like, you know, they're going to stalk and kill and eat that particular individual. So, but as human beings, we have this higher level of conscious awareness and the ability, you know, this underlying sense, you know, depending on the character of the individual, this underlying sense of right and wrong. And, you know, depending on your moral development, some people have this to, say, like a high degree. Maybe some people have it to a middling or to a, say, like the beginner's level. So, but, you know, that's what makes us human, makes us, like, intelligent. You know, we have the ability to make choices. And, you know, you can choose to move in a particular direction, and if you know, you know, if you're quite sharp and aware, you know you will have an awareness of the results of the direction that you're actually moving in. So you know, the principle is, you know, the intention, you know, you deprive a living being, you deprive a living being of life with full, you know, say with full intention. There are shades of grey. You know, it's not absolutely black and white carved in stone, because phenomena is very, very changeable. The human mind is very, very changeable. You know, you're going to see like an alteration in different scenarios and conditions. But so, you know, you could potentially, you know, take the life of a cow or a horse or some small creature because it's suffering. It could be maimed, it could be hurt, it could be disabled. And, you know, that small creature, or that small or large creature, if allowed to live, it could be, you know, could go on in incredible pain. And so, especially even with vets, you know, they're almost like bound, at least to a middling to, or major degree, to end the life of the small creatures which are brought to them, unless their owner protests very, very strongly, because there's always, like, especially with even with medical doctors and vets and veterinary surgeons, people within the hospital system doing professional surgery, they're under a legal framework, and if they don't do their job within, like, legal guidelines, the potential for prosecution, for lawsuit, the potential is there. So, you know, this is why, you know, I've heard this on a number of occasions. People have spoke to me about this with their pets, and the owner knows full well when their pet is uncomfortable, or their kitten or their pussycat or their Labrador or their Doberman, you know, it's in pain. You know, owners are very intuitive; they can see that quite clearly. But, you know, if you give your vet full rein, you know, they may be quite quite prepared to put your pet, you know, lethal injection or I'm not sure if there's any kind of special gas that they use with the with animals in the surgeries these days, but, you know, they tend to, like, orientate in that direction. You know, if an animal is suffering, that, you know, you essentially, you know, you put it down. So, and then the second precept, not to steal, you know, to steal the property of others, or to steal that which does not belong to you. So, you know, but also that, you know, there are shades of grey even within that particular format. So, you know, if you may have the wish to basically steal something of someone's, you know, just through say like pure greed or possessiveness, and but you know, you could, it's quite possible that that person could have given you say like invitation, that that individual gave you say invitation based on trust, where you can take my property like any time, anywhere, regardless of circumstances, unless they actually set the guidelines. So you know, it's possible you can take people's stuff, you can borrow people's stuff, but it's understood. You know the mindset of that person, the expectations, and you know where you're coming from. So you know, you're looking at a step of awareness. You know, you know where that person's coming from, you know where you're at, and it's understood the connection between you, you know, exactly what path you're taking in regard to this principle. So, you know, but, you know, sometimes people, they can take things without permission, but, you know, they are quite prepared to return them, maybe possibly in good time. Or you could have a person who steals a library book, or a person who borrows a library book, but they're not prepared to give it back for maybe 3 months or 6 months. You know, so you know, you're looking at sort of like variations on a theme, so to speak. And within the monk's rules, you know, there's like five factors. You know, where which makes it crystal clear exactly where you're coming from and the direction you're heading and the number of steps that you're actually taking as you move towards taking possession of somebody else's property. So the third precept of speaking intentional lies to another individual, you know, I mean, when if you lie to another person, I mean, what actually is your perspective? Is it outright deceit, or are you just telling maybe just a little white lie or a fib, or are you actually, you know, are you telling that person something, you know, maybe you could be softening the pain or softening the blow of some, you know, maybe traumatic or you know, some experience which may be quite unpleasant to them, or you know, something I've mentioned previously. You could be a nurse in one of the surgical wards, and you know, one of your patients is going in for surgery. So you've got, you know, two guys in the ward who are friends. One's going in for it's a cardiac ward. Both are going in for cardiac procedures, and you know, these two particular gentlemen in the same room, been friends for years, so. The gentleman goes in, has a full procedure, comes back, is in intensive care, in recovery, and then he asks the nurse who is looking after both of them, who's doing the prep for theatre, how did Bill go with his procedure, and she's not going to tell the second gentleman anything which is going to worry him and raise his blood pressure and affect the outcome of the anaesthesia, because you know, you got an older fellow, you know, 60, 70 years of age. You basically don't want to compromise him in any way, because things go wrong, he could potentially die. So essentially, you may mislead that person, or essentially, tell a very, very, a very direct, you know, white lie. But your main principle, your main intention is to protect the health and the integrity of that individual. And but you know, in general society, to tell fibs and misrepresent the truth, you know, it's just so easy. You know, if you talk too fast, you know, if you exaggerate, you know, if you're joking around, you know, it's very, very easy to slip and to misrepresent or distort the truth on some level. But you know, but if you look within yourself, you know, I mean, why, you know, all these precepts, they're essentially sharpening your mindfulness and your underlying awareness. You know, precepts are like, they're like training rules. They're principles which sharpen your underlying awareness and your mindfulness. Because without precepts whatsoever, you know, that person's mind is just it's just all over the place. It's like potentially it's just like a minefield, you know, like an accident waiting to happen. So if people don't have any moral guidelines whatsoever and are completely out of control, you know, essentially they're just capable of absolutely anything on any level. And the fourth precept of sexual misconduct, and so within the sutta analogy, within its strictest, sexual conduct is to engage anyone, say like male or female, outside of a formal, say boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife relationship. So if you play with anyone outside a known and recognized formal, say, emotional, physical relationship, then essentially on a physical level, that's sexual misconduct. And but what's the context if you're a single person, but you know you still like to connect with other people on a casual basis? You know what is the understanding or the criteria in that particular sense? And you know, like, you know, the kind of perspective I would have is, the bottom line is, if you don't harm other people, you don't harm yourself, you take necessary precautions as far as contraception and one guards oneself against, and other people against, HIV or STDs. I don't have the mentality where I'd sort of get on my high horse and then start judging other people. I don't really consider that to be my perspective. But you know, if people are sensible, responsible. Because you know, people, they don't want to be celibate unless you're actually planning to become a monk or a nun. The vast majority of people, they don't want to be celibate, but they're not necessarily interested in full time relationship. So you know, from my I've already explained the strict parameter, but as long as people are essentially sensible in the way they conduct and relate to other people in that format. And the fifth precept, not to take drugs or intoxicants which confuse and delude the mind. So probably quite a number of you have got quite a high degree of experience in this area, possibly previously or even currently. And so essentially that, and you know, this is, many of you are aware, this is just another common sense principle that, you know, when we toke up, or you know, when we, you know, maybe sniff some different types of powder, and you know, might inject, you know, certain substances, that you know, we're looking towards an alteration in consciousness, essentially for, you know, both to change the mind, the consciousness, maybe to increase awareness, to increase paranormal experiences, to increase one's personal bliss, happiness, you know. It could be all sorts of different reasons. But, you know, if you're in a state where, you know, and I saw this on a piece of material previously where they had a small group of people, you know, like quite sharp, bright young people in their teens, and then they got them absolutely whacked on, you know, on some very, very good quality cannabis, you know, at least, you know, probably 4 or 5 cones, and so they were, you know, they were really, really off their heads, and then they put them through a number of tests, and they had them walking in the forest and jumping over streams, and then, you know, there was a, like, sort of dialogue and discussion and questions and answer and test of reflex and all this kind of thing, and within their own minds, they felt that they were in, you know, they were in, had quite a reasonable degree of control, you know, their coordination was satisfied, you know, was acceptable, you know, this and that, but, you know, these people were, you know, I mean, completely, you know, I mean, you know, really quite, you know, what, like, well, you know, wouldn't, you know, they put, if you put them under, say, like, under really demanding conditions or, you know, demanding tasks or, you know, you can just imagine something very, very heavy, demanding, stressful. I mean, you know, the vast majority of these people just couldn't perform whatsoever at their full intellectual capability. And which is completely obvious to the vast majority of you here. But, you know, but naturally, you know, people like to do, you know, some people like to do drugs, you know, they like to change their consciousness, expand their consciousness and whatnot. But the sensible thing would be to do in, you know, sort of in a safe environment with conducive people, and, you know, essentially, so you know, you're not driving a vehicle, you know, you're not, you know, so you could be a babysitter, you don't want to get yourself maybe stoned or really high when, you know, when you're looking after somebody else's children, that may not necessarily, may not work out so well. So, essentially, you know, the intoxication effect, you know, once it starts to impair your faculties, your sharpness, your memory, which the vast majority of alcoholic beverages and you know, the smorgasbord of drugs which are available do quite successfully, you know, it all depends exactly where you're at. Most people, you know, because, you know, drugs are everywhere, you can get them at the drop of a hat. And alcohol, you know, bottle shops are virtually everywhere. You know, very, very easy to source. But, you know, if you're a meditator, if you're a Buddhist, you may choose not to go that way whatsoever. And, you know, even in the past, you know, where I was at, when I was a layperson, and I would probably went out on a Friday, Saturday night, and on particular nights I wouldn't drink whatsoever, because I'd be driving a group of people, and you know, you could just see how smashed people would get themselves, and they were really incoherent, they were slurred, the coordination was out the window, they didn't know what they were doing, what they were saying. And some of the things that these people did were just absolutely crazy or incredibly painful. And, you know, so, you know, some people, they see the limitations of intoxicants. You know, some people think, oh, you know, I don't feel relaxed. I don't feel comfortable when I drink socially and whatnot. Well, my attitude is, you know, why don't you just develop your people skills so you can actually talk to someone without, you know, without having, you know, 1, 2, 3 middies or a couple of spirits or a couple of cones, you know, if you need to sort of, you know, to sort of get off your face before you can communicate with other beings, that other people, you know, that sort of indicates there's something wrong there. And I'm not saying that you're a vegetable or you're dysfunctional or anything, but you know, all of you are, you know, you've seen this many, many, many times, but You know, from my perspective, you know, if a person went to a party and didn't drink, I really believe this, that you can actually have a better time without being intoxicated. You know, you can have fun and you can laugh and you can joke and chit chat and engage and entertain people. You know, you'll probably be able to do this far more effectively than if you were sort of stoned or tanked up. So, you know, a lot of these things are just completely obvious to people in general. You know, very easy to research these kind of things on the web. So, you know, there are many, you know, there's great value to, you know, keeping these moral guidelines in everyday life, because, you know, when you've got that, you know, when you have a sense of sharpness, clarity, and awareness, that means that both physically, emotionally, and intellectually, you know, you are at your very best. I mean, you know, who wants to be compromised? Who wants to limit, you know, their say their emotional or their physical capability? And so, you know, in general society, by say keeping a moral structure, you know, what's the actual effects of that? You know, so you've got a person who abstains from intoxicating, you know, drugs and alcohol. You know, what's the effect of that on a community level? So you usually find that, you know, that person, they tend to, you know, the relationships with other people tend to be of a better quality. You know, the relationship dynamics tend to be on a much more consistent or trustworthy the level. You know, the person makes less mistakes, you know, has less mishaps in life, you know, because they're less prone to accidents and getting themselves into trouble or having, you know, say like car accidents and this kind of thing. You know, because you've got, you know, a degree of like sharpness and awareness, you know, when you're fully conscious. And so naturally, even from the health perspective, because you know, because I worked in the psych area for 12 months or so, you know, it's, you know, if you really go you know, go quite heavily within the, say, the drug or the alcohol fraternity, and you really hammer it, that usually within a couple of years, you know, you're going to start to see changes in that person's personality. And you know, the what would you call it, the stability, especially the stability of the personality and the quality of their intelligence. So, you know, and, you know, people, especially when they're young, you know, they can really go hard with the drugs and alcohol, and, you know, they look like they're holding it together, they're doing okay. But as you move up into your, so, you know, people can go crazy in their 20s, but when you move up into your 30s, that's when you really, you know, you don't have the same kind of, what would you call it, say, like reserves. You know, once you hit your 30s, you know, you'll see the aging process start to kick in. And if you really go over the top with the intoxicants, you're going to actually see the effects of it much earlier. And those unwholesome effects, unconducive effects, you know, they're going to come in a lot earlier, and they could be with you, they could actually stay with you a lot longer. So, you know, if you reach the point, you know, especially with cannabis and hashish and especially with, you know, crystal meth, if you really go over the top with that kind of stuff, that you know, you could have symptoms and side effects which, you know, which are going to, which could easily stay with you for for 5 to 10 years, and potentially, I mean, it could just ruin the quality of your life and your relationships with your family and friends. You know, I mean, I've seen this at least, well over a couple of times. And so, you know, there's a lot of benefits to remaining sober. And so, you know, there was a particular sutta that the person who's able to keep a moral structure, they're a person who has, depending on your personality, has a minimal level of underlying, say happiness or joy, to at least a small degree. Because with the precept structure, when you observe the precept structure, it protects you from worry and concern and from fear and from shame and from those, you know, and from actually undertaking a wrong course of action which will disturb and unsettle the mind. And, you know, because the mind works on say cause and effect principles. And so, you know, any person who keeps the five precepts, you know, many of them have at least a minimal belief in karma and rebirth. So, you know, people who keep the precepts quite well usually find that they have a very, very full and firm belief in the law of karma, you know, law of cause and effect and the process of rebirth. And this is the reasons why they're actually quite careful in the way they conduct themselves in, the general community. And because, you know, every single move you make under the power of intention, you know, every time your mind moves and you think and feel, you know, you're generating karma on a moment to moment basis. So, you know, nobody gets away with anything like whatsoever. And when you start to meditate, that's when you become very, very aware of what you actually think, do, and say on a daily basis. And especially, you know, the regular meditators, people on retreat, their mind becomes a mirror for the quality of your mind or mind consciousness. So you'll be able to see exactly where you're at. If there's been any underlying infractions, misdeeds, you know, they will come to the surface and they will come up with full awareness. But you know, this is part of the process, part of the Buddhist understanding. This is where you actually develop your understanding and insight. Because if we didn't have that underlying awareness coming into consciousness, you just couldn't see exactly which direction you're actually moving, where you go wrong, you know, where you actually go right in life in general. It's a matter of this kind of underlying intuitive awareness. So, you know, there's lots of, you know, but the proof of the pudding is, you know, the people who keep, a minimum moral structure, whether you're Christian, Muslim, Hindu, in general, you know, their tendency is that they orientate more towards a sense of happiness, you know, peace of mind, contentment to at least to a minimum degree. You know, they're the kind of person who finds it easy to make friends, to sustain friendships. They don't get into problems and difficulties to any significant degree, and it just makes your life, you know, so much more, you know, so much more, so much more, more easy, and smooth and less troublesome in the long term. So I'll finish it there, and I'll open the floor if anyone has any challenging questions whatsoever. No takers. Oh, there's one lady in the front. That's yep. Lady in the crimson, dark crimson top, with a hand in the air. You're waiting for the mic, microphone. She's waiting for the mic. Wonderful.
Thank you very much for a very interesting talk and a lovely meditation. I'd just like to talk about the drug influence. I have a friend who actually does biofeedback therapy with people, with computers, and they can pick up when a person's on drugs because their aura is damaged. It's actually got holes in it, it's damaged, and it actually can allow in attachments, negative entities, which can create the psychotic attacks. And unfortunately, there's been personal experience in my family. I lost my son through drugs, impure heroin. 30 people died in that month. And my niece, she just started experimenting with drugs at uni. First of all, just marijuana for a few months, and then she went on to ecstasy and she had a psychotic attack and ended up crazy in Greylands Hospital for 5-6 weeks, and now she's out, but she's really struggling with coping with life. So it is a terrible thing. A lot of people think it's only marijuana, it's only this, it's only that. But some people are very sensitive and they get damaged very easily, and I just think it's very sad that people don't know the terrible consequences. It can ruin their lives. And unfortunately, with my son, it was given at a party, heroin. And heroin is a very, very strong drug. Very, very strong. It just gives you absolute bliss, and people can't often resist that. And so, yeah, we really need to be very aware and strong and pray for the world, pray for people on ecstasy, people on, especially on ice. Also, I'd just like to mention where I live, I had neighbours that were on ice, and I was ringing the police because this guy was screaming and yelling. 4 o'clock in the morning, he was having these attacks. They had young children, and I rang the police many times, and then finally I rang the council and had people come out, and I was praying for them, chanting for them. I'm a chanter. I chant and chant and chant. And a year later, those people are totally different. That guy hasn't been, there's no, I think they had a lab there for a while, and I was getting smoked out with the smoke from the place. Anyway, that's all changed. A year later, they settled down. There's no screaming at the kids. There's no wild parties. There's no, you know, this extreme attacks at 4 o'clock in the morning. No smoke coming in. So our prayers are very, very valuable. We can make a big difference to the community. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a very good point. Infusing other human beings with positive vibrations. But was there anyone else at all? Okay, look at something. Okay, so we've got Jacob from Boston, USA. How can we best pursue a life career morally? For example, a doctor must give up or sacrifice time with family, which may create angst, regret, and sadness. All right, how can we pursue a life career? How can we pursue a life career morally? Well, I mean, it's probably not that difficult. You know, if you've if you're a reasonably sensible person, and you understand what morality or precepts are, you're well aware of the benefits of following a moral system, within your capability, I wouldn't consider that to be such a struggle. But then you've got the personal things where, doctors have to, student doctors have to study, quite hard, or they may have to give up a lot of their personal time if they're, a specialist in the hospital system, or they're on call and this kind of thing. But, you look at the big picture. If you want to move in that direction, look at exactly what the capability might be. I mean, some people might want to become a surgeon or maybe a pediatric specialist, but these are quite demanding professions, and you could easily be working absolute minimum 9 to 10 hours a day and be on call on weekends. So which way do you want to go? I mean, I've never met any doctor who's told me that their professional practice was a breeze unless they're actually working part-time, unless they actually, sort of dictate the hours. So, if you're a single person, it's not so difficult. But if you've got, partner and children, just look at the big picture. I mean, just think of what's going to happen. I want to move in a particular direction, but, what is going to happen 3, 4, 5 years from now? And, the options, the perspectives, and that may give you an idea exactly what you're up against, because these days people really have to work quite hard to make a living, to get ahead, to pay off a house and everything else. So you really don't want to make life any harder than it already is. People have to score economically the way things are these days. So look at the big picture. 5 years from now, 10 years from now, where am I going to be? My family, friends, do I have much time? Do I have much free time myself? Do I have my weekends off? Do I have time for hobbies and interests, or am I going to bust my guts for, till I turn 65? So, Ubal from the Maldives. It's a nice location. What are the factors that could build mental morality? So what I would say is awareness, the factors that build mental morality, coming to an understanding, doing a little bit of study in this area. What actually are precepts? Why do human beings need to be moral? What are the benefits of a moral structure? And do a little bit of study and learn. Learn a little bit about it, but essentially, you're looking at awareness. If you've got a person who's completely ignorant, without knowledge, without understanding, how can you expect them to be moral? The people that I see who are moral people, the components I see within that individual is that people who are naturally moral, who've never been forced by their parents or by their partners or this or that, usually find they've got some past life experience, so they've got the past karma, which is conducive to maintaining a minimum moral standard. From the time they're kids, they're 3, 4, 5 years of age, and you can see it within the personality. The kid has a sense of goodness, they're kind, they don't scream the place down. They don't give mum a hard time. And as one lady said to me the other day, her daughter's had a little baby. The child's about 3 months old, and she said that the child lost her wings, meaning that the child had come from an angel realm, a Devaloka realm, before she was reborn as a human being. So the child is very, very quiet, peaceful. She smiles But the kid's only, she's only 3 months old, and she's already forming sentences. She's actually stringing words together, and she's at the beginning stage of forming sentences. So most youngsters, I mean, it's usually around like the 9 month mark where they really start to talk, as this particular, this registered nurse was telling me. So this kid is, you know, this baby's really, really starting early, and she's in, you know, she's in good shape. So, and yeah, just, but that same thing again, awareness, knowledge, information, you know, you understand the benefits, you know, you have this awareness of if I move, you know, this is like intelligence, it's like emotional, intuitive intelligence. If I move in a certain direction, you know, what is going, you know, what is the potential, you know, what is actually going to happen, the variables. Okay, Shamida from Dubai. How best can we follow the five precepts 100% of the time and be mindful 100% of the time? Am I being moral if I do not? Well, you know, I don't follow the precepts 100%, the monk's rules 100% of the time, you know, 16 to 18 hours of the day, you know, all my waking hours. So, you know, what my attitude is you know, that just that same principle again, understanding, awareness, you know, you have a good knowledge base, you know, you know what you're working with, and you know, intention. So as you move through your everyday life, as you walk and talk and you're chatting with people and you're doing your job, you know, do you understand exactly what you're doing and why? You know, roughly every minute of the day. You know, like I wouldn't say every moment of the day, because you're talking about from a second to second perspective. And the only people I expect to be completely mindful and fully aware, essentially, are people who are completely enlightened, where the mind is just absolutely razor sharp, and the mind's as pure as the driven snow. And these people, they just do not break precepts with intention, like, whatsoever. The underlying causes are just not there at all. So, you know, you just do your best. It's underlying intuitive awareness, and this and trying to be mindful, you know, 100%. Of the time, you know, there's little tricks that you can do. You can do like a mantra, one mantra, you know, so like a short mantra every minute of the day to sharpen your awareness, your mindfulness, your recollection. Because as soon as you forget the mantra, then the mindfulness is sort of dropped at that point in time. Or you do things like, you can do this very relaxed, spacious mahasi kind of approach where you label your mind and body experience. So, you know, like every thought that you think, you can do this roughly every 10 seconds, every 20 seconds. You know, you need to be a bit careful if you're driving a vehicle, or, you know, you're operating machinery, or you're looking after children, you're cooking a meal. But you can do it in a very, very spacious way, this mahasi labeling method, which will still increase the sharpness of your mind. It's just that, like, it's a skill, you know, that you can develop. And say, for example, if you're sharp enough where you actually notice an infraction, you notice that you're having a chat with someone, and then you just slipped, just very, very lightly, you just maybe told a very, very small white lie, or maybe you exaggerated, you know, you got sort of got caught up in the heat of the conversation and you misrepresented the truth. You know, if you were able to catch that within the first 5 to 10 seconds, that's pretty sharp. So, you know, what a person can, they can remind themselves, or the Tibetans have got a nice little practice where every time they break a precept knowingly, they recite their Om Mani Padme Hum mantra 3 times to establish the mindfulness and the recollection. So every time they break a precept, they say the Om Mani Padme Hum 3 times and bring the mind back back to its like center. And it's quite it can be quite useful. So each person will see what practices actually are of support to them in the long term. So there's no more takers, so we'll shut it down, call it an evening. Thank you kindly for your participation. So I'll hand it over to our friend there. Would you like to take the floor? I can't remember. I don't know your first name. Leha? I'll remember. Yes, there will be. I'll announce it tomorrow. And we'll get the sheets. We'll have sheets. How many sheets do you reckon I should print? At a guess. 25 for the regulars. Okay, shall do. 25. You're right. Did you didn't want to add anything? Shall we just pay respects and we'll split? Okay, thank you very much.